smattering of people kind of all across the country. It was very good.
A couple of weeks ago, there was a station in Guam on 10 meter CW. I could just about pull them out using a remote site in the Hudson Valley. And he heard me, but apparently busted my call because I came up as not in log on Club Log, where the DX stations upload your log to see if you upload their log to see if you're in the log. So that was disappointing. I've been chasing that guy around for a while. Now all of us who are into DX and islands are chasing this. Desecheo Island, which is actually a remote operation, kind of weird, but I think he's running off solar or wind power and is kind of puny weak and drops off unexpectedly because the batteries aren't charged. So go ahead.
Oh, well, it's a shame he missed your call sign. Maybe you should kind of send him a hello there QSL card just so he has it around the next time you try and make contact with him.
Question.
Yes, Brian?
Oh, I don't mean to throw off the subject, so...
Okay, I put you down on the list, so unless it's pertinent to what we're talking about now, I as long as you're a stick with us, we'll get to you.
No worries.
Okie dokie. Wes, are you out there? I don't know what happened. You lost your microphone, or someone was just throwing a empty carrier at you.
Someone was putting an empty carrier on me, I believe. No, but the only question that I had is that we have material that is used in our spacecraft to shield from excessive heat that spacecraft where the astronauts are. And I thought that maybe similar material was in the vat that could contain a life form that came from outside.
Again, is there a chance? Yeah, there's always a chance. Is it likely? I don't think so. The only one who probably would disagree with me is Dr. Avi Loeb, who believes that comets are spaceships and such. But heat shields are very sophisticated structures, objects that decelerate. Rockets are sophisticated things, and usually comets and meteors are just a big heavy rock with some iron and a bunch of other minerals in it that aren't particularly designed to do anything except be part of the substructure of planets and moons and other heavenly bodies that aren't radiating sun-like energy.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. The only subject that I have in addition to that is Prosky versus Kesterreich in solar panels. If you could say a few words. The reason that I brought that subject to you was that the efficiency of that promising Prosky is 13.2%, but is absolutely inexpensive, so you could buy 10 panels of Kesterreich for the same money that you buying perovskite, and it doesn't contain any toxic materials. So we're talking about lead and the other materials that are in very much promising perovskite, and we do not have it in test right, then utilization of the solar panels and ability for regular Joe to purchase it is very much promising. Back to you, Andrew Xian.
Well, you know, as I emailed you, this is very early. They don't have an actual a piece of the material. They're simulating it, which is not a good sign. So whether it can actually be properly manufactured in a cost-effective manner is an unknown. You know, stabilizing it is an unknown. All these things are terribly important. It's not ultimately important what the raw material costs you, because you know if you're kind of designing things that are built out of diamonds, the base material is carbon. You know, carbon, coal, and what charcoal and such is dirt cheap. But you know, when you have to manufacture it in the form of a solid, a flawless diamond, the production costs go sky high. So this is just the very beginning. They don't even have a practical piece of material to test. They're simulating it on computers. So when they actually build some of the stuff in real world terms and get to test it, then I'll be much more interested. At this point, it's just something to get a grant, a research grant on. It's about all it's going to accomplish in the foreseeable future. What happens 10, 15, 20 years down the road, who knows? It may revolutionize everything. But I wouldn't bet my last buck on it.
Okay, interesting. Well, misunderstanding or maybe the problem that I have is that I read the University of New South Wales, UNSL, W in Australia, has broken the new efficiency record. They built the material that is reaching 13.2, so it's not a simulation. And they did it by a treatment with hydrogen. But when you look at the material they use, copper, zinc, tin, and sulfur, it's nothing there that we don't like. Nothing there that is difficult. All of that is abundant material that we can find anywhere. And talking about 10 panels versus one, so you can buy 10 panels for the price of one perovskite. Back to you.
Yeah, but the problem is right now you can't, and the next week you still can't, and probably a year from now you probably still can't. So something might be theoretically wonderful, but if it's not available anywhere, then that makes it far less useful in the short term.
Okay, thank you very much, and I appreciate your time. And to Xia.
You're welcome, Wes. Chet, are you out there?
Yep, I'm here at WB2AHK.
Okie doke, what's your subject for tonight?
All righty. I just want a confirmation on an idea I had. I'm hoping that tonight there's some electrical technicians that might be aboard to confirm an idea that I have. It involves hooking up a generator, a portable generator, to the house electricity. That's my subject.
Okay, about it. You know, we've kind of discussed it, and Dick, may rest in peace, would bring up the subject, especially in Plymouth weather that we're having now, the possibility of power loss. There's a smart way, there's a real stupid way. A real stupid way is there are these power cords that have two male connector on both sides. You think they call them a suicide patch because it's a very unsafe way of feeding power into your house, it can bleed over into the utility line even though it's unpowered and cause utility workers to die because they pick up some of the current. The correct way is to get a transfer switch that goes where your fuse box or near your fuse box and basically cuts off the connection to the utility and replaces it with the connection to the generator. But is there any specific aspects of the question you're interested in, or just a general overview?
There's another way, AF2P.
Okay, please share.
I'd like to hear about the other way. So what happened was we lost power here a few days ago in the village of Floral Park for like 4 hours. I have a small generator, which I backfeed into the house. Of course, I turn up the main breaker, in the house. I don't have a transfer switch. And so I have an outdoor 110, 115 connection on the back of the house. And with my smaller generator the last couple of years, I backfeed back into the house and it powers up some of the circuits in the house. Most of the things I need are supplied. But I just discovered in my head anyway, why don't I try something else? I have an outside window air conditioner. Well, I have a window air conditioner, 220 volts, and I was wondering if I could make up a suicide cable for my new generator that can power the whole house. It's two or three times as powerful as the original one, and power up the window air conditioner's 220 line that's outside the house. It has a box and everything, and all I have to do is plug my suicide wire, I would assume, into the 220 line there. That's my question. Is that feasible or is that a problem? That gentleman might have an idea, another way. I'd like to hear his idea. Over.
No, please. I'd like to hear.
Do I have it?
Yes, you do.
Okay. There's a very simple way to lock out your main breaker versus the breaker that allows power to come into your panel from your generator. It's a little piece of metal and a screw. And it pivots one way, it mechanically prevents either one of those breakers from operating. You push it the other way, and it flip-flops. The one breaker that was off is now turned on. The breaker that was on is now turned off. And to the second breaker, not the main breaker, but you add another breaker, and that's the one that will be locked out or locked in by this mechanical device, you wire your generator. And it's impossible to backfeed that way, and you'll be safe. And it doesn't cost much.
I see on the internet, on Amazon, they have these transfer switches. The prices have come down really low, like $99, $139, and so on. And I was going to look into that. But in general, by turning off my main incoming master breaker that feeds my house, in my case, it's 100-amp service panel. I know, of course, I just flip that switch, and there's no power coming from the outside power company. So I thought I would be safe that way. Are you saying I'm not safe that way, and I might electrify the outside lines if I just turn off my master switch on the service panel?
You're not safe because you've got a mail at both ends. So your an end that's unplugged is hot. Whereas if you have the wires into your breaker, there's no hot. You can't touch anything hot. The wires are connected to this additional breaker. And it's much cheaper, way cheaper than a transfer switch. Ideally, a transfer switch is the greatest thing since sliced bread, but it costs you a bucket of money. This thing is a few bucks. I'm going to look for on the internet, see what it costs. I think I spent 10 bucks on mine. But I paid an electrician to do everything. There was a whole bunch of stuff going on. So, you know, the cost was, he was doing all this other work anyway, and the cost of adding that thing was just a couple of bucks.
KE2BTA. The device you're talking about, that's a generator interlock kit for the panel box. KE2BTA is clear.
Okay, yeah.
Okay,
I see it right here. I looked it up when you said that. There's one for 20 bucks on eBay. I don't know what it would cost at the electrical supply, probably more, but it's a great way to go.
Chip?
Yeah, all righty. All right, so I'm not doing anything wrong then. So if I had that generator panel interlock switch, and thank you for that KE2 station for that information. I looked that up. So I'm not doing anything wrong by trying to use the 220 air conditioner box that's outside my house, because the wires, it's a 30-amp line that comes from the main box. It feeds my, it was installed by an electrician about 25 years ago, a really good electrician. And it's still there, still feeds my 220 air conditioner. And it has a plug. It can unplug the air conditioner wire and just plug in the new wire. All right, very good. So I'm not doing anything terribly wrong, but I should use the recommended generator. Power generator panel interlock switch. Thank you very much. That's something to look into, and I appreciate it very much. Roy?
Put something wrong if you use a male plug to push power into your house. You must not do that. The male plug can be hot. You can kill yourself with that. I'm not saying you will, but that's the wrong way to do it. You want the permanent wiring, to be connected into the panel. You're not plugging anything, okay? You're going to have probably an R&S connector, which will be a... And it is dead because it's hooked to that breaker. You could actually touch those prongs, but those prongs can never be energized except by a female plugged into them from your generator. You never want to have a male plug energized that you could grab hold of with your bare hand.
PhD.
Yes, Jim?
If you don't mind, I can clarify this a little bit.
Sure.
Most of what's being said is correct, but the pieces aren't being put together fully. The generator interlock kit is a mechanical device that is placed on the face of the panel, and you have to have an incoming line from the generator upon going to a breaker that's next to the main breaker. And this device, that you can only have one of those switches on at the same time. So it's a mechanical device that doesn't let you have the incoming breaker from the generator and the incoming breaker from the mains at the same time. You can have one or the other, but it's a mechanical plate. It's a great device. It's cheap. It still takes some money to do the installation in the panel because you have to run a separate circuit. You might have to relocate the circuit that's next to the main because of the incoming circuit. And it's much less wiring than a transfer switch, and I think it's more versatile. While the male prongs are dangerous, they are by far not the most dangerous part of doing it other ways. You have to have it so not just you know that you're not powering, back feeding the mains and killing the guy on a pole, but somebody else in your house or somebody else that picked you up off the ground when you had a heart attack from shoveling or you had this set up. It has to be safe from everybody, not just from you. So those are the two concepts that I hope bridge some of the gaps in the discussion. KD2BHD, thanks, Mechanet.
Thank you, Jim.
Hey, Jim, KD2FIU, I agree.
Thank you, George.
Okay, Chet, you got a lot of things to think about.
Yeah, WB2HK, if there's my email, I don't mind giving it the same as my call letters, WB2AHK, the American Ham Kid in Floral Park, New York. If there's a, my email address is the same, my call letters at AOL.com, I don't mind giving it. And if any electrical technicians that can do that kind of work, maybe they can give me a call on the, do it properly, I should say, do it properly. But I like my new generator, it's really nice. It's something that I want to hook up. So if someone can contact me, if they want to take a look at my installation, maybe we can get together and have somebody professional put it in. Because I'm not a, electrical technician. I don't want any trouble. I don't want my nice house to burn down or anybody get hurt over here. But that's just me and my wife. There's nobody else here. It's not like I have a whole family of people. But my wife doesn't even know where the electrical box is. So I'm the only one in the house, or two people in the house that knows where the main box is. All right, guys, thanks very much. Appreciate it. Go on with the Roy. Go ahead.
Okay, very good, Chet. Thank you for your participation. Thanks to everyone who offered some advice and information. I appreciate it. Anyone with any closing comments before we move on?
KC2SHO.
Yeah, John?
Well, as a electrical safety officer here, and my job, follow the code, get licensed people to do this stuff. I know it's not the ham radio way, but there's reasons the code exists. They've used, decades and decades or 100 years of experience, however you want to look at it, to come up with safe, effective, and ways to handle these things. So, my opinion, read the code, learn how it works, do it the right way. If you want an online resource, the Mike Holt forums. Mike Holt is a guy who has real nice electrical forums. You can read what people have to say about these kind of things as well. So, just my two cents. Follow the code. KC2SHO.
Okay, John, excellent advice. Yeah, you don't want to ask for forgiveness if you screw around. And, any time a component is called the suicide cord, suggest that you really think hard and long about doing something. And, do it up to code, because screwing around against the code is not going to harm too many other people but yourself. So do it for your own sake. So thank you for that, John.
Roy, Chet again. What is John's call letters? He says it too quick. I'm hearing impaired. Roy, could you give it to me slowly in phonetics? I have trouble hearing. Go ahead.
Yes, Kilo Charlie 2 Solo. H O K C 2 S H O.
Okay, thanks, Roy. I appreciate it. Yeah, I lost that about 75% to 80% of my hearing in the last couple of years. Always been hard of hearing, but it got worse. Okay, thanks a lot, Roy. Appreciate it. Thanks very much, John. Take your advice. Hopefully I'll contact you.
Okie doke, Chet. When you do the deed, come back and tell us how it worked out.
Okay, will do. I'm going to do it.
Okie doke. Very good. Well, I think we did everything we needed to do with that subject. Sam, I hope you're still out there. Well, we'll come back to you again. Maybe you stepped away from the radio for a moment or so. Paul, what do you got for us tonight?
Oh, I just was curious if anybody operated, went to field day or, you know, well, maybe did what I did. I operated from the house and I made a whole bunch of contacts. It's interesting, you know, you look some of these guys up and some of them are in the middle of nowhere. One guy was with two clubs. They're using a cabin in the middle of the woods out in Ohio somewhere. So it's very interesting. But I thought it meant, well, storm and everything across the country, you know, it would cut back on operators, but there were plenty of people on. And I was on 15 meters, 20 meters, 80 meters, all CW, but, you know, a lot of fun. Anyway, I was just wondering if anybody else got involved with that. Back to you, Mark.
Okay, I was curious if Lymark was kind of doing anything about Winter Field Day, because I didn't get any emails that kind of mentioned it one way or the other. My other club, Kings County Radio Club, scheduled a Sunday get-together for Winter Field Day, but because of the terrible weather reports, they had to cancel it, and they substituted a two-meter net Saturday afternoon, which I'm told was very well, worked very well. Did anyone go on? Did Lymark have its own particular Winter Field Day event that I missed entirely, or was it kind of a non-club based get together that a few people had? If anyone had anything to do with Winter Field Day this weekend, please let us know.
No, I think they didn't plan anything for that. You know, I've been listening to all the meetings, and I didn't hear anything come up about that. Plus, today they had the virtual ham fair, so that kind of would have been a conflict. Anyway, it started at 11 o'clock yesterday afternoon, and it's a 30-hour event instead of a 24-hour event. So, And I've got a bunch of contacts, and the one guy, where the heck was he? I'm trying to remember. He was in Virginia, and it turns out he was a POTUS station. You know, could you imagine, you know, trying to make POTA contacts, and you're inundated with all the Winter Field Day people. Interesting. Anyway, back to you, Ross.
Okay, I got about the virtual meeting, so that would probably confuse too many people for a club-oriented Winter's Field Day and the virtual, get-together. I know someone who actually attended it the other day, and he won he won the last door prize of the day, an ARRL radio handbook. So he did well.
I didn't sign up for that. I made some more contacts this morning on, for Winter Field Day. And then I got involved playing with my snowblower. Back to you, Roy.
Okie doke. Very good. Let me try again. Sam, are you out there? Okay, we'll try again a little bit later. Brian, what do you got for us tonight?
Oh, good evening. I have an interesting question. In 2007, the FCC allowed the use of 2,200-meter band for amateur radio communications. However, on some band plans that I look at, on paper, 2200 meter, is not even listed. And I'm just curious. I haven't seen any rigs with it, and I'm just curious. Does anybody actually use 2200 meters, and what's on it, and how? What kind of equipment do you need to go ahead and utilize it?
Okay, it started off as an experimental. It's a very low frequency band. It used to, I think, be owned primarily by the Navy. They use it for submarine communications, but they've kind of shifted over the years to satellite that offers a much better solution for them. And so AMs were first given experimental access, and you had to have a call sign that had a X experimental letter on your call sign. But then they opened it to everyone. They limit the power. They limit all kinds of things. But there are they call themselves loafers because they operate on the low frequency. There's no real amateur radio hobbyist hardware available. You kind of have to buy old Army surplus or lab equipment that operates on those very low frequency range. Your antenna is fundamentally a compromise because you're never going to get anything that's half of a wavelength unless you own a farm place with a lot of empty land. So it's more of an experimentalist. It's kind of like, what do you do on microwave? Well, you play around with other guys who are into microwave. So you find some loafers. And you make a schedule, and you try and communicate back and forth. It's not like there are nets or regular type of activities on that frequency. Most people are trying to figure out how to get it to work.
DDH with a comment.
Sure.
That frequency is around 136 kilohertz. A couple of years ago, I did copy a guy who was, he was just, all he had, his transmitter was just essentially a beacon broadcasting his call letters. I think he was up in New England somewhere. His transmitter was just a couple of, a crystal, and I think he had a couple of TTL, a logic circuits hooked up as the oscillator. And another couple of TTL circuits driving the antenna. So it was essentially all TTL logic that was doing the transmitting, and it was just using a quartz crystal around that frequency. It was in the 136 kilohertz range. That works out to be the 2200 meter band. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's more for tinkerers than rag chewers, certainly. So, Brian, you were thinking of becoming a loafer?
No, not at all. I was just curious why the information on it was so sparse. And I didn't see any vendors with equipment. So I would think that it would be of an experimental nature, just like the microwave bands that ham radio operators could use. I think it's, 70 centimeters? No, I don't know if I'm sure on that. But related to microwave bands that the FCC allocated.
Yeah, microwaves are up there in the gigahertz, just above where Wi-Fi is situated. But yeah, it's sort of the inverse, but very similar. It's a bunch of people who want to be pioneers on a certain portion of the electromagnetic spectrum, and so microwave has been around much longer than very low frequency. So people who started as hobbyists. Then they start to sell kits. Then they put the kits together and sell it to you as a final product. So, you can get into microwave without knowing anything about building anything that's microwave. There's a company down in Florida that makes a lot of transverters The routine ones that upscale to 2 meters and 70 centimeters, but they also offer a selection of microwave transverters and such. So you have a much better chance of buying a product for microwave just because it's been around a lot longer than very low frequency. Right now, as far as I'm aware, there's no company, there's no mom and pop company. You know, it's kind of, you get a set of schematics and you tack something together, and that's part of the fun under those circumstances.
Okay, I understand that. So I have one additional question, if possible.
Yeah.
We all talk about half-wave antennas, quarter-wave antennas, full-wave antennas. Are we actually talking about a full sine wave, half sine wave, and a quarter of a sine wave?
Well, yes. If the sine wave is the carrier frequency, yes.
Now, what would that look like? I mean, are we looking on an oscilloscope? Do you actually see a fraction of that wave?
Well, I don't know exactly how you would hook that up to the oscilloscope because it's being fed through the transmission line to a radiating antenna operating as a standing wave antenna. We talked about that a little bit, I think, last week or the week before, that there's sort of two major categories of antennas. One is very common with us amateurs is standing wave, in which the electromagnetic, the currents and such travel to the edges of the radiating elements and then get reflected back. And you want something that's able to reflect back and stay in sync. You want additive interference rather than subtractive interference. If you have an antenna like a center-fed dipole that's a little bit more than a half wave or a little bit less than a half wave, it doesn't sync with the standing waves. The standing waves kind of move all over the place and lose some of their energy to destructive interference and such. So it's a half of a wave traveling in a standing wave antenna. So I don't exactly know how you would capture that onto your oscilloscope. You could display the carrier frequency for a distance of, half a period, a quarter of a period, and demonstrate, the fractions of a sine wave that's being generated at the point of the transmitter. But other than that, I don't quite know how you would actually manifest that type of a result.
Okay, getting there. So if you use a half-wave antenna versus a full-wave antenna, are you saying that in a full-wave antenna you're using 100% or close to it of the RF energy versus emitted versus a half-wave where it would be 50%, or is that not the case?
That's not the case. What happens with, to take a very rudimentary design like a center-fed dipole, the energy goes to the end and then gets mostly reflected back. Some of it bleeds off as actually radio frequency electromagnetic waves that you want to have to launch completely. You don't want them to be kind of absorbed and turned into thermal waste heat. That would mean that the efficiency of your antenna goes down. But the length per se does not directly correlate with the efficiency of an antenna. Just because it's a half of a wavelength doesn't mean that it produces a half of the energy and then it stops. It produces it in halves. So it goes, half of a cycle, then it reflects back for the other half of the cycle, and then it goes back and forth, could be hundreds of times before all of the energy you sent through the transmission line finally dissipates as radiated radio waves.
Okay, that I could accept, and I understand that. So what would be the advantage of a full wave versus a half wave from a transmission standpoint?
Well, Well, it sort of wreaks havoc with your impedance matching. It changes characteristics of the antenna. As you change the length of the antenna, you change the Q, you change the efficiency often, you change the bandwidth, and even the radiation pattern becomes complex. If you take a quarter wave vertical, theoretically the radiation pattern is a kind of a donut. But if you then change the multiples of that antenna from a quarter wave to a three-quarters wave, you're able to resonate it, you get the same impedance, but the radiation pattern is distorted and you get nodes. And there are some null points and there are some high points with high gain. So it makes for a much more complicated radiation pattern. And the characteristics of an antenna are modified by changing the classical length. So it's a different type of antenna, but ultimately it's sort of just a variation on a standing wave antenna.
Okay, got that. Last part to the question. Horizontal versus vertical polarization. Is it horizontal to horizontal, horizontal to vertical? How does it all work out with transmit and receive?
Theoretically, especially locally, the advice is to, if you want the greatest gain between two antennas, is keep their polarization identical. That's why, you know, repeaters have a vertical-oriented antenna. And when you're operating to hit a repeater, you should have your own antenna oriented horizontally, vertically rather. For single sideband 2 meter, the practice is different. People use directional Yagis oriented horizontally, and both people should do that. Of course, there's complications because there's always complications. Sometimes if you get reflections of your RF, the reflected RF can rotate its polarization angle. If you're operating skyway propagation through the ionosphere, a lot of times you'll get something called the Faraday rotation, which is actually the polarization angle rotates through the ionosphere so that although you might be sending vertically, by the time the guy on the other end is receiving you, it's pretty much oriented horizontally. So, you know, it can shift.
Okay, I got that. No, I understand that. So, basically, you could communicate with from a vertical to a horizontal to a vertical, but it's what do you lose in the translation between a horizontal polarized and a vertical polarized if you were doing point to point?
Yeah, well, again, it kind of depends if you want to talk theoretical or if you want to talk practical. Because a lot of strange things happen in the theory that don't really show in the practical. On the theory, if you look up an electrical engineering book and you try and figure out what the loss between two antennas that are orthogonal, oriented 90 degrees in relation to each other, the loss is almost infinite. So on a theoretical basis, you lose everything. In a practical basis, is that there's nothing perfectly horizontal or perfectly vertical. So ultimately, you can lose 10 dBs, 12, 15 dBs. If you're 45 degrees out of phase, you only lose 3 decibels of power. So some people, and that also happens with circular oriented polarized antennas. So that's 3 decibels, but. As far as being orthogonal, being 90 degrees opposed to each other, theoretically it's monstrously bad. But thankfully in the practical world, it's just not good at all, but it's nowhere near as bad as the theory would suggest.
So in a long wire antenna, would you say the radiation pattern is horizontal?
It depends on how you're orienting the wire.
Oh, obviously, you would be using the long wire antenna in a horizontal, with, you know, broadside to each side.
Not necessarily, but okay, then it would be horizontally polarized. But again, a lot of people don't just kind of string out the wire nice and straight. So then you got problems of what happens when you put a couple of kinks one way or the other, because you can't just, position it not straight. So then it gets kind of complicated and it becomes a mixed type of a situation. But just having a straight horizontal line of an antenna should give you a horizontally polarized radiation pattern.
Okay, and finally, absolutely my last question. What is the, if you were to pick a percentage, what percentage of amateur radio operators on HF use horizontal versus polarized, vertical antenna, sorry?
Well, I don't know. It's kind of difficult to say. I'm sure that actually the percentages differ in different areas. You know, the metropolitan area probably favors verticals, simply because they're kind of stuck for real estate to more than country people. You know, they have a couple acres, so it's not a problem to have some kind of horizontally oriented. But I don't think you could, I certainly couldn't guesstimate, you know, the percentages. I don't think anyone's really done the research. Not only is it kind of difficult to kind of collect all that, but a lot of people make their own wire antennas. So, you know, one day it's a horizontally oriented piece of wire, the next day it's a vertically oriented piece of wire. You know, it's as simple as finding some tree to kind of put some rope on it and orient it in a 90-degree way. But, that's why in the old days I had both a vertical and horizontal antenna, and I was able to plug it into my Flex. It's capable of receiving through two antenna inputs, and it can merge the signal and feed it to one ear or feed the other antenna to the other ear. So, you know, there's no particular reason why you have to settle with vertical or horizontal. You can get one of each.
Okay. Very well. Thank you very much, Roy. I appreciate the explanations and the clarifications. Always appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome, Brian. Anyone with any comments about this particular subject before we attempt to move on? Okay, let me try again. Sam, are you back yet? Are you out there? Okay, I guess he left us for the night. He may come back. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limark Technical Net. We do have a good 25 minutes if anyone is so inclined. If you have any questions or topics that you would like to discuss, this is the time. Hit that push to talk and ID yourself.
KG2RY, good evening.
Good evening, David. Do you have any subject for tonight?
Yes. Well, first, I hope you're having an excellent night. I was working on setting up my cameras for some shooting, and digital camera Canon EOS 5D Mark II, old digital camera, which enables me to make abstract pictures and no AI pictures.
Well, that pretty much every electric mirrorless camera doesn't thankfully have AI. There's a couple of new companies that hooked up equipment to cell phones, and they plug in to agents that produce photographs, but images. But with the exception of those guys, thankfully, most of the professional grade electronic cameras don't do AI yet.
Well, you know, you can get parts of the software that enable AI, and certain software more AI than other software. You know, when you download the pictures from your compact flash card, and process the pictures in AI, I think that's become very common.
Well, that's a different thing. What you're talking about is processing AI. I'm talking about in camera. In camera, you can't manipulate the image as much. You could change the settings for the image quality, the LUTs, if you will. But other than, and most of them still store a raw image if you want that has no processing at all from the camera. Once you get it out of the camera, then you could do anything you want with any picture, drawing, picture, what have you. There's lots of AI agents that are based on image manipulation, and even before artificial intelligence, people were playing around with Photoshop for decades. And it wasn't actually AI, but it was. They manipulated a lot of things. I'm sure you've seen. They ran stories about how fashion magazines would change the skin tone of models using Photoshop and such. So there's been image manipulation since there's been any kind of, even before there was software, because people, photographers were able to manipulate them at the camera just by dodging and burning and playing all kinds of interesting games in the darkroom. So, but yeah, there's many ways to kind of either improve, or usually most people kind of throw all kinds of junk. You know, if their software can do something, they crank it up to 11.
Yeah, I know about that. That's Spinal Tap. And also Photoshop. Yeah, I know about Photoshop. And I've been using it since the Mac 2 CI, Photoshop 1.0, and Super Paint. But I guess my question then would be, I have an iPhone 15. I've taken pictures with it, and I find that the images are noticeably manipulated according to, maybe you would say, algorithm, where certain parts of someone's body is elongated, you know, or some light and the color of the light changes, you know. When you didn't ask the phone to do that.
Yeah, a color balance. All these manufacturers are kind of using very similar camera optics from the same manufacturer, so their reason for existing is that they put algorithms in the image processor to improve color balance and contrast. I don't think directly it'll change the aspect ratio or the general body shape. There are, unfortunately, applications that have built-in, they call them filters. When you first got into your photography, filters was the little piece of glass that you screwed in front of your lens to change the color or polarize the light. Nowadays, cell phone filters will make women much more beautiful than they really are. They'll take rid of all the skin blemishes and apply makeup and highlights and all kinds of silly things. And every so often, especially a couple of years ago when COVID was new and people were using things like Zoom, there would be these stories of a guy who played around his Zoom filters and showed up at an important meeting looking like he was a duck. So, yeah, there's a lot of that out there, but I think the manufacturers for the hardware cell phones are limited to simple things like color tone and contrast and you know, more subtle things than making a person look taller than they are or thinner than they actually are. But there's a lot of software that does that, too.
Yeah, I guess you would call that elongation. You elongate the picture, it makes the person look thinner and taller.
Yeah, again, you'll see that in filters all the time, but as far as I'm aware, manufacturers of cell phones tend not to kind of do that automatically because, you know, you might not actually want that. You want something with an on and off switch, and for whatever reason, most of their manipulation is more subtle than that. So I'm not quite sure if you'll find any documentation that, say, iPhone has a built-in make-it-look-skinny filter.
Yes, yeah, well, it was odd, and I can see it, and, you know, it would be better if I could administer the effects, you know, on my own and make those choices myself. I have Photoshop, Lightroom Classic, and Bridge. You can rent the package, so I rent the package. If I, whatchamacallit, if I want to put a Nikon flash on a Canon camera, you know, there is a way to do it. It's not automatic.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, you, to a degree. The problem is that the smarter these things are, the more they require an adapter to do any kind of real sophisticated things, like setting the shutter to a speed slow enough that the entire shutter is exposed at one point during the flash. And there are adapters that are made for some interbrand manipulation, and sometimes it just kind of reduces it to a very primitive 1970s flash device that's not very smart and doesn't set anything. You have to manually set it all by yourself.
QSO. Yeah, I'm okay with manual settings. The Canon EOS 5D Mark II will take manual settings, and the flash will take manual settings also. And I put it on the top of the L bracket. I connect the camera to the flash with a PC sync cord, and that seems to work okay.
Yeah, you're taking it down to the simplest level where it's no longer sending you information that you said. You know, the modern day flash devices, you can set the shutter and the diaphragm levels, and it'll communicate with the camera. What you simply are doing is using the most basic fundamental control the flash has, which is, you know, it reads a closed circuit. When your camera closes that connection circuit, it tells the flash to discharge its capacitor. Now, keeping it simple allows you to use different brands with the same type of a camera.
USO, Nikon SD23. I have about six of them, and a Sunpak with a big bulb flash. And that has a PC sync cord attached to it. Then there's Canon, you know, Canon automatic flash. But I think a Canon automatic flash is too complicated. And the Vivitar 283, you know, that's pretty basic.
Yeah, well, I mean, Vivitar, I don't even know if Vivitar kind of exists anymore, so it's most likely an older model of a flash. But, yeah, again, it sort of depends upon how manual you can set it. To some of the flashiest, smartest automated flashes have still manual settings, and if they do, then you can set them all the way down to stupid and use that DC connector that on a lot of cameras. There are a few that have taken them off just because they feel they can get away with it. But, yeah, that's the most primitive, base type of way of handling.